He could be Ohio's next governor, and he has some ideas about higher education. Why Vivek Ramaswamy thinks Ohio has just too many colleges. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. Today on the News Review, the GOP gubernatorial candidates plan to consolidate universities. Plus, Kentucky Senate candidates debate, and rapper Afro Man emerges triumphant in an Adams County courtroom. But what has his rap song cost the Adams County Sheriff's Department? Never thought I'd be saying Afro Man on WVXU. All right, I am joined right now by Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Baumert. Jesse, good as always to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Ohio Republican gubernatorial hopeful Vivek Ramaswamy. He came up with what I'm just going to call a bazonkers idea this week. As our own WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson pointed out in his column this week as well, what Ramaswamy said was certainly not a joke or a hoax, and it was posted by his own staff. Let's listen.
I want us to have the best universities, but we have too many of them.
Absolutely.
They need to be consolidated. And when you consolidate them, they can actually be centers of excellence who are actually the best in their respective domains instead of trying to create replicas and clones of one another throughout the state.
Okay. So he wants to just, you know, get rid of a bunch of Ohio universities. What?
Yeah, this was an interesting one. And like you said, it's something that his own campaign posted on Threads and essentially was in response to a question about how Ohio would pay for eliminating the income tax, which it has been a priority of Ramaswamy and Republican lawmakers in Ohio generally. But in order to do that, you would have to come up with about, you know, $10 billion. And perhaps one of those ways is consolidating Ohio universities.
How would that save money?
Well, Ohio spends about $2.1 to $2.2 billion on public universities, regional campuses, and community colleges. And so presumably, if there were fewer of them, you would not be spending as much money on that. The idea of like consolidation in general, whether it be at the university level or at like the K-12 level, is something that gets floated by Republicans every once in a while because, you know, if there's dwindling enrollment at universities, you know, why not shove a couple of them together? But I think there's a lot of concern from people who are alums of those universities that I'm just picking some schools, you know, if you combine Akron and Kent State or something, those are two very different universities with different experiences. And so it was an interesting idea and interesting that his campaign posted it.
So is he sticking with this or has he tried to backpedal at all?
It's interesting. When I asked a spokesperson about that, he said that Vivek Ramaswamy was not going to eliminate Ohio universities, but he wants to cut bureaucracy that burdens them. Talking about like college affordability, which affordability has been a huge issue in the governor's race so far. So it was an interesting response to that because it wasn't like heads on. Obviously, the Democrats have jumped all over this and said, which universities do you want to cut? Ramaswamy campaign and didn't really engage with that questioning.
Right. I was going to say this has to be a goal mine for his opponent, Dr. Amy Acton. What has her response been?
Yeah. So Acton's initial, I mean, she's defended Ohio's universities as world-class colleges and institutions. She is a graduate of Youngstown State University, which is a public university in Ohio, versus Ramaswamy attended Harvard College and Yale Law School. And so trying to draw that contrast, which is the contrast that the Democrats are trying to draw generally.
Mm-hmm. Have universities said anything about this idea?
You know, I reached out to the Inter-University Council and did not hear anything back from that. I think universities are probably waiting to see if this is like a real policy position or, you know, something said in response to one question about income tax cuts.
Yeah, fair. How many, you know, public universities are there in Ohio? How many would this even affect?
Yeah, so Ohio has 14 public universities, 24 regional campuses, and 22 community colleges. We have dozens and dozens. I couldn't find the exact number of private universities, but I'd be surprised if this kind of policy would affect them. And so, yeah, I think Democrats have jumped on this, especially with March Madness happening. And I don't know if it's a record number, but a large number of Ohio universities are participating in the basketball tournament. So the social media reaction kind of writes itself.
Yes, my grad school alma mater, Miami, would not. They're going to be busy today in March Madness. Now, this would seem to fly in the face of previous and current Republican governors, right? Like DeWine and former Governor Rhodes were big proponents of public education, right?
Yeah, Jim Rhodes, one of his like quotes that he was known for was that he wanted to put a college education within 25 miles of every boy and girl in Ohio. And so that was really a priority. You think about places like my alma mater, Ohio University, which is kind of in a region that doesn't have a lot of other higher education options. And so a lot of these universities serve as kind of both a job creator and like an educational powerhouse for those communities. And then Governor Mike DeWine recently has been working to keep the doors open and like the sustainability of Central State University, which is the state's only public historically Black university, even though that institution has faced a lot of financial, academic, even some safety issues. But he's really been committed to keeping that going, even though there have been some issues there.
All right. Thanks for that rundown. Let's take a switch now. Adult beverage makers across the state have been scrambling to prevent a ban on THC drinks that was supposed to take effect today. First of all, can you recap the ban and did it take effect today?
So it did take effect today. There were two things that really were trying to block this. One was this ballot campaign trying to collect enough signatures to block the law and put it on the November ballot so people could say yes or no to this particular policy. And then, of course, there are a couple of legal challenges, one in Franklin County and another at the Ohio Supreme Court. And effectively, a number of changes in this bill, but it bans THC-infused beverages, which is kind of one of the more popular headline items. But it would also restrict hemp products. These products could be sold in dispensaries, but right now they're pretty available at, you know, corner stores, sometimes at breweries and so forth. And so this is a dramatic reduction in these types of products.
So it's, and it is kind of hard to keep track of it. There's two lawsuits, I think, that you just said, right? There's the one from some local brewers. I don't know if that's the right word here in Cincinnati. And then, so what's the status there? You know, how are those going?
Yeah, so we haven't heard from the Ohio Supreme Court on that challenge from the Cincinnati Brewers. And so absent any action, the law took effect today. We'll see if the Ohio Supreme Court jumps into this issue, but I would be a little bit surprised if they do, just considering the makeup of the Ohio Supreme Court, which is pretty predominantly Republican at this point. One of the issues is this law passed. Initially, state lawmakers wanted the ban on THC-infused beverages to take effect a year later, kind of in line with what the federal law was doing. But Governor DeWine, who has been pretty opposed to these types of products, he line item vetoed that. And so made that take effect with the rest of the law. And there have been some legal challenges questioning whether he had the ability to do that. So that's something that's at the Ohio Supreme Court that would really only affect those beverages. And then there was a kind of 11th hour lawsuit filed by a Cleveland seltzer company and some other folks who are saying that this is interfering with interstate commerce effectively. Like, we can't sell these products from other states and you're making our businesses either illegal or in some cases have to shut down entirely.
Okay. So we're just kind of waiting at this point to see what the courts do, right?
Yeah, the Franklin County judge actually ruled yesterday that they weren't going to block this law at the 11th hour. That doesn't mean that this lawsuit won't continue, but the Ohio Supreme Court also hasn't stopped anything at this point.
Okay, we'll move on then. Crash in a school zone here locally killed a local teenager, but the distracted driver got off on misdemeanor charges. I think a lot of people would say, you know, got off on with a misdemeanor charge. And his mother was shocked that the sentence could be so light. Tell us about Aspen Runnels law that's proposed at the Ohio legislature and how it will change the penalty for this kind of violation.
Yeah, I think folks are surprised that a lot of car crash-related either injuries or deaths are misdemeanors rather than felonies. And Aspen Runnels was killed when crossing a crosswalk outside of Lakota East freshman campus in 2024. The driver at the time was speeding and like checking on her baby's pacifier. And unfortunately, the teenager died 10 days later. And the sentence was 30 days in jail for their death. And so the mother and just other folks have brought this to state lawmakers who would like to increase the penalty, make it a fourth degree felony by punishable by up to 6 months or between 6 months in prison and a year and a half in prison, or also create a felony if you injured someone seriously in a school zone. The distinction being, like, if you're in an area where you're supposed to be slowing down, that there might be flashing lights, that there might be a school cross guard, that this should be taken even more seriously, you know, than other pedestrian injuries.
Yeah, but I mean, there's so much talk about school zones, and then we have construction zones, and the penalties are so much higher. Has there been talk at all, why would they not already be higher like they are in a construction zone for a school zone?
Yeah, I think that is a question that state lawmakers are posing. I think there is a concern from folks that, you know, why not just increase the penalties for all pedestrians? Like, why carve out construction zones and school zones? But I think these particular areas are areas where there's like a lot of alerts that you should be driving more safely, you know, like there's a lot of warning and so forth. And so this would also increase fines for just even if you didn't injure someone or you didn't kill someone, if you were speeding or distracted driving in this area, you could also face like a double fine. So really trying to deter this kind of behavior, especially when it impacts children and people trying to just get to their work at schools.
What kind of support does the bill have in the House there?
So it recently passed a committee. I think it could get a vote on the House floor as soon as next week. The Ohio legislative schedule is a little interesting this year because it is an election year for so many people, including the governor, as we talked about earlier. And so they're going to do some work this week, next week, take a break in April before the primary, have a few more sessions, and then they'll have a long break before the between the summer and the November election. And so just all legislation is on an interesting timeline because of that, but this would have to pass the Ohio House and then pass the Ohio Senate. That's not saying it can't happen if there's kind of the will, but that weird schedule is going to make it just a little bit harder to get through.
This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm speaking right now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Ballmert. Thank you so very much. Let's move on to another sad case of someone being hit and killed by a vehicle. Hamilton County Sheriff's Deputy Larry Henderson was struck and killed while directing traffic during UC's graduation last year. Tell us about the proposed Larry Henderson Act.
Yes. So this is a bill that would eliminate the possibility of parole for anyone who kills a police officer, corrections officer, prosecutor, first responder, military member, essentially saying that the families of these individuals shouldn't have to come up to the parole board and say, we think this person should stay in prison. So either they would face life in prison without the possibility of parole or the death penalty.
And does it eliminate like other options that, that folks could be charged with? It feels a little all or nothing to me.
Yeah, I think if you were convicted of killing a cop or some of these other people on this list, there would really only be two options for a sentence, and that is life in prison without parole or the death penalty. So some of the concern or opposition to this bill came from like the Ohio Public Defender, who it was concerned that we're by mandating like these penalties for only one occupation, you're kind of making a value judgment about, you know, which lives are more or less important.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to ask you who opposes it. Is there anybody else opposing it besides the public defenders?
Groups that just oppose the death penalty generally. Ohio hasn't executed anyone since Governor Mike DeWine took office in 2019. That's in part because of like access to death penalty drugs, but he has repeatedly been, you know, delaying executions in Ohio for that reason. I think most people suspect he has had a bit of a change of the heart on death penalty. So folks who just don't like capital punishment at all don't want this to be one of those two options for convicted killers.
You already kind of laid out the schedule for the House and Senate, but where does the Larry Henderson Act stand right now?
Yeah, I think this is going to get a vote next week on the Ohio House floor. Really doesn't have any opposition. This passed unanimously through committee. It's something that at least the committee was interested in. So we'll see if there's any kind of opposition on the House floor. And then, of course, that would have to go to the Ohio Senate as well.
All right. And then finally, you also wrote this week about the latest attempt to circumvent abortion protections approved by a majority of Ohio voters and inscribed in the state constitution. This week, Representative Gene Schmidt introduced a new proposal related to so-called fetal heartbeats. Can you explain this idea?
Yeah, I guess I wrote a lot this week.
Yeah, but, you were very busy.
Yeah, so Gene Schmidt, who is from Loveland as a Republican, would like to require medical professionals file a certificate of life within 10 days of detecting a fetal heartbeat. This would be in addition to like a certificate of live birth, which you would get once a baby is born, and then would also record all fetal deaths. Right now, state law only requires it after 20 weeks of gestation. And so she sees this bill as a way to acknowledge life that might end before birth if someone has a miscarriage, for example. But I think abortion opponents or abortion rights advocates are opposed to this bill because it really harkens back to a few different things that Ohio has passed related to banning abortions after fetal heartbeats. And they're concerned about just creating a registry of pregnancies. And what would that mean?
Did she say why she thought this was needed? Like, what was the impetus?
Yeah, so she talked with a constituent who basically said they would have liked to acknowledge their children's lives before birth, also discussed the bill with a relative who had multiple miscarriages and, you know, just kind of like an acknowledgement that that existed prior to death and so forth. So Representative Schmidt is also a very pro-life, anti-abortion lawmaker, has advocated for other sort of abortion restrictions. She says that this would not impact someone's ability to get an abortion and thus would not run afoul of the 2023 abortion rights amendment. The voters approved with about 57% of the vote. But I think opponents would say edgewise.
And does this legislation address at all this idea of a fetal heartbeat? Because there's a lot of discussion about when you are actually hearing an actual heartbeat versus something that's being amplified by, you know, the Doppler or the equipment being used.
You know, it just says fetal heartbeat, so it doesn't really make a judgment call on when that would occur. But we did have a lot of discussion about that because Ohio has a law that has been blocked. But the law basically said that abortion couldn't proceed after fetal cardiac activity, which was as soon as 6 weeks gestation. And that took effect for a few months after the Dobbs decision was overturned. And so this concept of like fetal cardiac activity or fetal heartbeat has just been really charged in Ohio politics.
All right. And then I know it's still early, but just, you know, in the last sort of 20 seconds here, does this bill appear to have any legs? Is it going anywhere?
It has just been introduced, so we'll see. But you really see an effort from lawmakers who oppose abortion trying to kind of work around the edges of this 2023 constitutional amendment. There's another bill that could get a vote as soon as next week that would kind of reinstate a 24-hour waiting period, even though that's been struck down by a judge. And so just looking for different ways to either challenge or kind of work around that constitutional amendment. So I think we'll see that more and more from the Republican-controlled state legislature.
Jesse Ballmert is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. She's everywhere all the time. Jesse, nice talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, fiery questions for a Trump nominee. Senator Rand Paul lays into Trump's pick to head DHS. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Tayana Weingartner in for Lucy May. The Kentucky Senate race is shaping up, but the nominee to head DHS is getting a grilling. Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman are here to explain it all. Hi, Sylvia. Hi, McKenna.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump's pick to replace Kristi Noem as head of the Department of Homeland Security is a first-term senator from Oklahoma, Mark Wayne Mullen. Sylvia, for those who haven't followed this closely, who is Mark Wayne Mullen?
Well, like you said, he's a first-time senator, and he has kind of gotten himself a reputation for being a little pugilistic. I think that was actually perhaps the word that Senator Rand Paul used. He is a former MMA fighter, and he has been a staunch advocate for President Trump's immigration agenda. So it's not necessarily a surprise that he was the pick here, but he has also had an ongoing beef with Senator Rand Paul, as we heard about quite a bit in that hearing.
That's right. So during that confirmation hearing on Wednesday, the most notable sort of questions came from Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. Let's take a listen.
You told the media that I was a freaking snake and that you completely understood why I had been assaulted. I was shocked that you would justify and celebrate this violent assault that caused me so much pain and my family so much pain. I just wonder if someone who applauds violence against their political opponents is the right person to lead an agency that has struggled to accept limits to the proper use of force.
Sylvia, give us the backstory here with the attack on Senator Rand Paul.
Right. So Senator Rand Paul is referring to an attack he suffered many years ago from a neighbor. It was pretty big news at the time. And as we heard in that hearing, he suffered some pretty serious damage. I think he said 6 broken ribs and a damaged lung. And essentially, he's referring to some comments that Mullen made at the time, Rand Paul that he understood the attack against Rand Paul. Paul says that he had never heard that, that Mullins had never said that to him to his face before. And it was quite the argument between the two of them in that hearing. Rand Paul has spoken about this attack quite a bit and about, you know, toning down rhetoric and, standing against political violence of that sort. And that he was unsure that Mullen took that same stance.
And McKenna, there were also references that, you know, Sylvia alluded to, like pugilism. There were references to a caning event that's like 160 years old in Congress. What was that about?
Yes, I mean, there were a lot of different instances brought up. I think also at one point there were questions about if dueling is still legal among sitting members of Congress. Kentucky's oath of office famously has a very long list of references about candidates who assume office, about saying that they've never competed in a duel with deadly weapons. That includes everyone from our governor to local attorneys and things like that. So this was definitely a very tense moment in Congress.
And Sylvia, it almost seems like Paul was saying, if you condone these types of vicious attacks, then I don't think that you should be in charge of Homeland Security. What was your take on Paul's overall assessment of Mullen's character?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to Mullen's character directly, but Rand Paul has been critical of DHS, you know, in the past few months over some of its conduct, over, you know, the shooting of Alex Preddy, for example. He held a hearing in the same committee grilling DHS officials and saying, you know, did they have the right essentially to shoot Alex Preddy? Was he a threat? At what point is a use of force appropriate from DHS officials? And so that's what he was really alluding to here. He was asking Mullen, can we trust you to be a good example for DHS employees in the face of what is clearly some struggles within the agency, some really broad public concerns over if the agency is using force correctly and appropriately? And so Paul was asking whether or not Mullen is the right example, is the person to lead the agency in this moment of so much public outrage and concern.
Mm-hmm. McKenna, anything else that you would want to add there?
You know, I think this moment kind of really lays bare some of the tensions we're seeing among Republicans in Congress. You know, on one side, we have the very Trump Republicans like Mullen, who I think even brought up that Rand Paul sometimes votes against the president in this meeting. And then you also see Republicans who are kind of shirking their party in some way and voting against the president and his nominations as well.
So where does this nomination stand, McKenna? What happens next?
The committee did vote to forward it. Paul obviously did vote against it, even though he is the chair of the committee. But with Democratic Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, that vote made it out of the committee. So it now heads to the Senate floor for a vote.
Okay. After many, many years, speaking of the Senate, Senator Mitch McConnell is relinquishing his seat in Congress at the end of this term. Those vying for the Republican nomination to take his place gathered in Louisville on Monday for the first debate leading up to the May primary. That May primary is on May 19 in Kentucky. McKenna, who's running?
Yes, so we have a lot of people that are running for this office. Three of the most notable candidates on the Republican side are U.S. Representative Andy Barr, former state attorney general Daniel Cameron, and businessman Nate Morris. They had a very lengthy debate here in Louisville earlier this week, which was the first time that they got a face-off directly in front of each other. They have appeared at events before, but this was the first time that they were really responding to what the other one said. So, you know, I think this is going to kind of shape up where we'll see Republicans voters finally make a decision heading into this May primary.
What's your assessment of the debate? How did it go?
I think it was a very interesting debate. For the most part, as expected, we didn't see a lot of policy disagreements among them. It does feel like all three Republicans are making border security a cornerstone of their campaign. That was an issue that they all felt very strongly for. But we also did see them try to make the case that each other or their opponents would not be the best person suited to tackle that in the Senate. We also see a lot of competition between the Senate candidates for wanting to tie themselves closer to President Donald Trump, all vowing to vote for his agenda while in office if they're elected to the Senate. The president has not made an endorsement in this race so far. And, you know, there's some back and forth on if he will make an endorsement. You know, it would help the candidates if they were endorsed by the president, because then they could turn to voters and use that as an argument to vote in favor of them. But for the president, he doesn't really have an incentive in this race to pick someone and risk them not getting the nomination next month, because this seat has been long held by Republicans anyway. So it could make more sense for him to make a play in this race later this year.
Sylvia, what would you say was the biggest topic of the night during the debate?
I think McKenna said it exactly. It was really a competition of who is going to support President Trump the best. Really, that seems to be the main topic of conversation in this debate and in this entire race. You know, you see almost constant press releases about, you know, supporting President Trump's agenda. And I don't think there's been any instance I can think of where they've disagreed even in the slightest bit with President Trump. You know, they talked a lot about the Iran war, supported it unequivocally, said, asked any questions about, you know, should we put troops on the ground? How long should the war continue? Their stance was, I trust Trump unequivocally. So that's really been the tenor of this race and the tenor of that debate. So no big shakeups as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And McKenna, you wrote that you thought the Iran war was a big theme of the night. Did you want to add anything there?
Yes, I definitely think that that was an issue that came up frequently during the debate. I think as that progresses over the next few weeks, it would be interesting to see if the candidates change their responses in any way. Kentucky, that's an issue that's close to home in Kentucky because we've had a few service members that are from this state that have died, and that's made some headlines here. So if that continues to evolve, if more voters seem to be against the war, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out before the May primary.
Sylvia, were there any sort of standout moments, big surprises, big gaffes, anything like that?
Well, you know, one of the moments that was certainly was the most heated. There was quite the contention between Congressman Andy Barr and businessman Nate Morris, basically arguing with each other over their records. Nate Morris, while he was a businessman, signed some sort of pledge to DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Barr said, you know, can we even trust you if you would sign a pledge like that, versus Morris accusing Barr of, voting for things that didn't stand up to, you know, President Trump's current agenda. For example, he accused Barr of having blood on his hands for voting in favor of offering some special immigration status to Afghanis who helped the U.S. military when the U.S. withdrew. So there was definitely some heated moments there. And I thought most, politically interesting also to me was that Daniel Cameron, who was literally put in between the two of them as they were arguing with each other, at the end of the debate, he said, I think that this shows you that these two are more interested in arguing with each other than serving you. It was just kind of an interesting moment politically. It kind of set up Daniel Cameron, who really did kind of go through that debate without a lot of people shooting shots at him directly, setting himself as kind of the more consensus, more mellow, if you will, candidate versus Barr and Morris, who are the more maybe combative, I don't know if that's the right word, but they're the more fiery candidates arguing over each other's records, really. Because, like, as we said, there's not a lot of policy differences between the three of them.
Okay, McKenna, just real fast, we have to move on. Do you think there's a front runner after the debate?
I don't feel like there's a true front runner. You know, I mean, Daniel Cameron has been leading the polls, but as the other candidates make a name for themselves, that lead has diminished a bit. Okay. So I definitely think there's still an undecided quarter of voters in this primary.
Okay, let's switch to the other side of the aisle now. On Tuesday, the top four Democrats vying for the same seat also took to the debate stage. Sylvia, a real fast rundown of who's running here.
Okay, so we have four top candidates, I suppose, but the two with the biggest name ID are going to be Amy McGrath, former fire pilot, and Charles Booker, who is also former state representative, but both of them have run for Senate before. Both of them have a lot of name ID in the state. They had some expensive campaigns, especially Amy McGrath. It's got a lot of national media attention for her race that she lost to Senator McConnell. Both of them running again, so very familiar. Then we also have state rep Pamela Stevenson, who is kind of currently the only current elected official running. And then we also have Dale Romans, who is a horse trainer in Louisville. So he's kind of a real outsider. He's running as a true centrist in this Democratic primary.
Was there a key issue that the candidates focused on that distinguished them from each other?
Sure. There was a couple. There was really two main ones where they seemed to vary a little bit. I would say talked about Israel quite a bit and whether or not they supported unequivocal support to Israel. The candidates did differ a little bit on that. You know, Charles Booker and Pamela Stevenson were more on the, they explicitly called Israel's war in Gaza a genocide, and they said that they need to hold Israel accountable for that. Amy McGrath still said that Israel should be held accountable for its actions and that they should that support should not be unequivocal. But she was not quite as harsh as the harsh is maybe the wrong word, but it's quite as strong on the issue as Booker and Stevenson were. And then also one of the big issues was over ICE. I think that there were some clear distinctions, some clear delineations among the candidates over whether or not they would want to completely abolish ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or if they would want to reform the agency, again, with similar splits, you know, between the more progressive candidates like Booker and the somewhat more moderate candidates like McGrath.
Kentucky's such an interesting state. It had elected Democrat Andy Beshear in 23, but then went for Trump in 24. How do the candidates feel about the likelihood of a Democrat taking McConnell's seat?
I think that there is some skepticism of whether it's possible, because you're right, we do have Governor Beshear, but he has really outperformed almost every other Democrat in a statewide race. I mean, every other Democrat, I should say, in a statewide race. He's kind of considered by Democratic strategists as like the top threshold of what Democrats can do in Kentucky right now. And though he did win his governorship with a sizable amount, it was 5%, though. It was not like the kind of margins we see for President Trump, not the kind of margins Republicans can get. And so while, yes, they did vote for Beshear, I think there's some questions of whether that same sort of dynamic is possible in a federal race, in a race for Congress. I mean, we haven't elected a Democrat in quite some time here in Kentucky for Senate.
Well, we shall see. I know that you, Sylvia Goodman, and McKenna Horsley will also be following it very closely. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Up next, when life gives rapper Afro Man lemons, he makes lemon pound cake, and it gets millions of views and lands him on trial. This is Cincinnati Edition.
The Adams County Sheriff kicked down my door. Then I heard the glass break. They found no kidnapping victims, just some lemon pound cake. Mama's lemon pound cake.
Rapper Afro Man went viral with his hit Lemon Pound Cake, but the song and his album led the Adams County Sheriff's Department to sue. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner. WCPO reporter Jay Shakur joins us now. Jay, this isn't exactly the trial of the century, but it really was the trial of the week, right?
It definitely was potentially the trial of the year in Adams County.
For sure. All right. So for the uninitiated, who is Afro Man?
Afro Man is a musician, rapper, songwriter, as we know. He's from California, but has a home in Adams County. And got himself into some hot water.
Yeah. And I feel like people are probably saying, like, Adams County? He lives in Adams County? How'd he end up there? Do we know?
We don't know. That's okay. Been a question that we all have. But he is there. He has a home there with his wife and children. Not certain that he lives there full time, but he does have property there.
Okay. So what's the backstory? What happened at his house in 2022?
Yeah, so in August of 2022, Adams County Sheriff's deputies were executing a search warrant on his home there in Adams County on suspicion of drug trafficking and kidnapping. They found no evidence of it, so therefore he wasn't charged. But that's what led to all of the events of this trial and what led to this trial. That was in August of 2022, and then in December of that year, that's when he started making music, recounting from his view the experience. He wasn't home at the time of the raid when they were executing the search warrant. His wife was, and his children, according to people at the scene and according to him. They, again, executed this warrant, didn't find anything. In executing it, they broke down his door to get in, to get entry, and obviously began searching his home for evidence, which they did not find.
And he was incensed by this whole course of events, and he made an album, right? Tell us about the album. Actually, first, let's take a little bit of a listen to the song Lemon Pound Cake.
He's a Adams County sheriff. He's hungry and he's big as hell. He was sniffing for weed. Then he smelled another smell.
What was that?
Mama's Lemon Pound Cake. It tastes so nice.
So that's a little taste, but it wasn't just one song, right? A whole album. Tell us how big this album got.
Yeah, it was a huge album, multiple songs. A few of the songs that got notoriety focused specifically on the descriptive nature from his view of what happened during this raid. On YouTube, paired with the album release of the actual music, on YouTube, he released music videos that have gotten well over 3 million, closer to 4 million views per video, per song. So it really took on a life of its own. It led to merchandise with caricatures of some of these deputies and Afro Man himself on shirts, sweatshirts, and things like that.
So let's move on to what happened this week. The Adams County Sheriff's Department sued Afro Man. We should say his real name is Joseph Foreman, right?
Yes,
the Adams County Sheriff's Department sued Joseph Foreman in civil court. What was the lawsuit that led to this trial?
Yeah, they were suing for about $3.9 million. It's a defamation lawsuit, civil lawsuit, so no criminal liability there. But it did go to trial, obviously, and went before a jury. They were claiming, and their claim was that these videos depicting them and using mainly surveillance video from his home that showed them engaging in and executing the search warrant, and the caricatures on certain merchandise and social media posts that he made about certain deputies by name, alleging that they had committed certain crimes or engaged in certain activities, harmed their reputation, damaged their character and the public perception of them, and also caused distress and pain and suffering. So they were suing again for $3.9 million.
And what was Foreman's defense?
Foreman's defense, it was simply, this is my free speech right to say what I want to say through my art, through my music about you all. You all are, referencing the Adams County Sheriff's deputies, public servants, and you're not immune to criticism from a citizen. Particularly if that citizen feels that you executed a warrant aggressively or that you falsely, went into their home. Particularly, he made allegations that within the course of searching his home, obviously didn't find any evidence of kidnapping or drug trafficking, but they did confiscate things, return some things, but confiscated, he says, allegedly $5,000. Which when returned, $400 of it was missing. So he made all these allegations and he was simply saying, hey, you broke into my home, that's his terminology, and broke down my door, caused damage to my property, didn't find anything of evidence to arrest me. And I have the right, based on the First Amendment, to say what I want to say and critique and criticize you all.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that free speech argument that he was making. You know, there's the money that was seized from his home and how he actually used his own surveillance cameras in the making of the album.
Yeah, so the surveillance video he used was from the many cameras throughout his home and on his property that showed them executing the warrant, going through drawers, going through CD cases, going through some of his suits. He has very colorful, vibrant suits, going through his closets and things like that. And he used that video, particularly the song Lemon Pound Cake. The impetus from it comes from what appears to be in one of the videos, a double take that one of the deputies did when they saw on what looks like his kitchen counter a container holding some type of dessert. And so he used that footage throughout the video. He did do some reenactments as well, which was a part of the case as well. But mainly it was that surveillance video from his home, which was the basis of his claim of First Amendment rights. This is my video, my property, on my property. And I'm using my voice artistically through music to criticize you. And I have the right to do that.
There's quite a bit of nuance to this trial. I guess we'll give it away. Foreman won, he argues. But the deputy said, you know, we got death threats and it changed our small community. And even a female deputy got very choked up. When she talked about, there's a song about her. It's very graphic. It's very profane. Tell us a little bit more about what she says she went through.
Yeah, she claimed, she, as you mentioned, that she and other deputies received death threats. And one song depicting things allegedly about her personal life really drew the ire of many in Adams County to her specifically. One deputy alleged that the pressure from the song and the attention the song got and the death threats in Adams County and all of the things that came from the public allegedly led to rupture in his family and marriage. And so that was a moment, one of the more emotional moments of the trial, when they play this particular song, as you mentioned, very graphic song about her, this woman, female deputy, where she, you could see her crying and she's visibly emotional as the song, which thousands at the time and eventually millions heard.
So what did the jury decide?
The jury favored or decided in the favor of Afro Man, Joseph Foreman. Therefore, he does not have to pay the $3.9 million in damages. For him, it was a victory. We haven't heard directly from the attorneys after the verdict of the deputies or from the deputies themselves. But they decided in favor of Afro Man, saying he did not defame them. They deliberated for close to about 8 to 9 hours. That day, they kept asking to replay certain videos. They had a few questions. They kept coming in and out of the courtroom asking to play certain videos and review certain evidence that was presented at trial, but they ultimately decided in favor of Afro Man.
All right, and we will give him the last word. Here is what Joseph Foreman, also known as Afro Man, had to say after the trial.
I'm home. If I go to a different area, I got to deal with a different police department kicking down my door, disconnecting my cameras and stealing my money. So my battle is won here. I think I'm going to lay my head.
All right. That is it. Jay Shakur, reporter extraordinaire for WCPO. Thanks for giving us the lowdown on Lemon Pound Cake.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. And our technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Tayana Weingartner. Please tell your pets I say hello and have a great weekend.